This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. All so that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is probably best known for his tenure at Bethesda. His story is amazing. He was an intern on Fallout 3, then ended up being the lead quest designer all the way up on Starfield. So I'd like to welcome the amazing Will Shin. How you doing, man?
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. That was a very lovely introduction.
Yeah, well, it's a cool story. And one of the things I wanted to ask, because from what it seems like, is the early days, the internship on Fallout 3, and even the early days as a designer on Skyrim, it was like a trial by fire.
Oh, yeah.
Would you say right?
So the story is, and I've told the story a few times, so I hope it's still true. I think it is, but it's also stories are stories. But when I interviewed for the design internship at Bethesda, they sat me down and said, "You're not getting a job."
Yeah, that's right.
Once this internship is done, we're kicking you out. We don't care how well you do. You have to be prepared for being unemployed by the end of this. So of course I said yes. That's a great deal. You know, I also took a 50% pay cut, which, you know, I wasn't being paid well at my previous job, so it wasn't that big of a deal. But when the time came for the internship to end, they were very true to their word. I was out pretty much the day after. But there were no hard feelings. Like, it was just literally, hey, we're not hiring in the design department, period. So once it's done, it's done. And I just hung out. Like, I refused to leave, essentially. You know, anytime there was a social event or a launch party, I was there, right, waiting in the wings saying, hey, I'm still around. So when the opportunity came up that they were hiring, you know, I had an in, essentially.
So who are your interviews with both times, both the internship and on Skyrim?
Let's see. I think for the internship, it was Bruce Nesmith and Ashley Chang. I think they were the only two people I talked to, although I may have also talked to Jeff Gardner. I don't remember. And for Skyrim, it was Bruce again, I think Ashley again, but also Todd at the end.
Wow.
Because I had met and talked to Todd a couple of times during the internship. And I think at the time, he still wanted to talk to every person who got hired onto the team personally, full time, all the permanent full time hires he talked to personally before they were hired.
So what's the dynamic been between you and Todd over the years then? Because obviously as the company's grown, he's become more distant, because that inevitably happens, right?
Oh, it's such a large operation now, you know, Indiana Jones just came out and he was involved with that. And that was Machine Games in Sweden on top of everything happening at Bethesda proper and everything happening at ZeniMax Online, which is its own thing going on. But, you know, it's still the Elder Scrolls, really key property. So but by the time I entered as an intern, Todd was already really important. You know, they had just done Oblivion, the Elder Scrolls Oblivion, which was a big success for them. They had just acquired the Fallout license, and they were, you know, gearing up to, I was part of the production for Fallout during the internship, Fallout 3. So he was already the undisputed, you know, leader, the person in charge of Bethesda Game Studios. So we never really got to know each other personally before, because by the time I had entered the organization, he was already like game industry famous.
Yeah.
He knew Adam Sessler personally. You know, he was on I forget the name of the show. I think it was G4 TV, Adam Sessler and Morgan Webb. I think he was on that show a few times. I don't quite remember, but he was already a name in the games industry by the time I entered the industry as an intern. So he was always very high above. And even as I ascended the ranks, you know, I was just ascending the ranks as the organization was growing. So he remained further and further away. I was eventually in meetings with him every week with like the rest of the leadership, but that was pretty much as far as we go. And I guess my one regret from my time at Bethesda was I came in after the point where you could know him personally. And I was always really curious, who's the person, you know, who's the person behind the fame, you know, because once you're that famous, and you're in charge of all these people, you can't, you know, it's really hard to let people in and show, you know, your weaker, more vulnerable side. You know, how's he like with his family? You know, what really like makes him mad? Like, does he hate Tabasco on his tacos or whatever? You know, those little things that really make you human, that only the people closest to you get to see, those more vulnerable parts of you. And that's just not possible. You know, he wasn't even my boss. He was like several rungs above me, you know, when I came in at the lowest. So that was never going to happen. But that was always something I was really curious about. What is it like to actually be that person? No one will truly know but him. But there were a lot of people who were a lot closer to him because they had come up together when the future was much less certain. You know,
yeah, that's right.
And so you get a lot of moments of vulnerability in the games industry and in other creative industries with people that you're working with in times of great uncertainty, because you're working together all the time. It's very intense. You're creating something from nothing. So it's a lot like giving birth to a child, to use that analogy. And everyone has a vision of what the future could be, but we all don't know what the future will be. And if there's no previous success to buttress that up, then it could be a disaster in the making, or it could be something grand and unpredictably great. So going through that together creates really tight bonds and allows you to see people in a way that sometimes only their family members or closest friends get to see. And that's something that I experienced with a lot of my colleagues at the same level as I kind of came up in my career there. But for the leadership, that had already happened to them. They had already been through making Daggerfall and Morrowind and Oblivion together. And so those bonds were already formed, and there wasn't really any room for anyone else because they had already had that experience. So that was something that like I was personally sad about. It's like, oh, I'll never know what it was like to have shipped Morrowind when the stakes were all on the table and no one knew what was going to happen. And so, but that's also like, I'm sure there are people who came in after me who are like, oh, Will was there for Skyrim. You know, what was it like to go through that? And I take that for granted because I experienced it. But people who came in after me probably had the same feeling of ennui that I felt towards the people who were high up when I was hired.
It's interesting because for some reason, and maybe I had this wrong, because I thought that like on Starfield, you would have been third in the chain. I thought it went Todd, then Emil, then you. So I just naturally thought that you might have had more to do with them. But it sounds like there was still a buffer between the two of you, because you probably would have reported to Emil more. Is that how
I report to Emil? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I report to Emil and we'll report it to Todd. So yeah, it's like third down the chain. So like I said, I was in a lot of meetings with them over it, but for most of my career there, I was mostly working with, you know, my colleagues in the non-leadership level. And then once I was in leadership, there was some more back and forth, but it wasn't that intense, like, personal collaboration that you would have gotten in the early days. That's really what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, were we working together and talking through the game together, like, on a leadership organizational level? Yeah, 100%. But it wasn't the, like, are we going to make it, you know? Is this going to be a success? Do I have to look for a new job? Those kinds of intense conversations that I was, that was, had already happened by the time that I had entered the organization.
So there's a story where you worked on the Skyrim quest, Taste of Death, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I've heard the story that Emil pretty much came to you and was like, this is the worst quest in the entire game and you need to level up. Now, I think if it was me, it would feel like a knife to the heart, but I'm wondering how you actually dealt with that and then just proceeded forward.
Oh, well, it was even worse because that was in public. We were having a design meeting. Yeah, we were having a design meeting, and he said that in front of the entire team. You know, this is an example of everything we're doing wrong, and you know, something needs to change. And I'm like, what? Jeez. Does he mean I need to get better, or I need to like get fired?
That's brutal.
So that was super brutal. It was super brutal. But I will say now that I lived through it. And I know what happens. It's a lot easier to say this. I didn't know this at the time, but what had happened was that gave me a lot of freedom because I knew the end was coming. I'm like, okay, I'm going to get fired at this rate. So let's just throw everything out. Forget it. Let's forget about how I was making everything before. Let's forget about why I was doing it. Let's forget about rules, any rules, perceived rules or things that I should be doing because it's obviously not working. And let's just make something that I would actually play. And so I redid, it wasn't just the Taste of Death, it was everything. All of the content that I was on, including the City of Markarth, all the quests in the City of Markarth, all the danger quests I was responsible for, all the systems I was doing. It was a lot of content that I just sort of chucked. And I redid all of it. And that's when things finally started to work. And I was getting good reviews. And then all of a sudden, they asked me to do the opening, which is a huge honor.
Like, yeah, it is a huge honor.
Deliver the opening for our next major game. That for going from maybe you should just resign to, oh, look, why don't we give you the opening? That was a huge turnaround.
Yeah, that's cool. What's your personal view on openings and tutorials? Because obviously you've worked on the opening, because you did Fallout 4 as well. You did the opening cinematic?
I did the opening for Fallout 4. I worked on the opening for 76, and I worked on the opening for Starfield
realize you did the opening for Starfield as well. So what's given that you've done this multiple times now, what's your opinion on it? Because obviously this is probably one of the most important aspects of a game because it's the very first thing that a player sees and does.
Absolutely. I think the one thing I would say, which is worth thinking about if you ever end up doing an opening to a video game yourself, is it is overwhelming to start any new game. You need to let the opening breathe a little bit. Almost a minute passes before anyone says anything in the opening of Skyrim. It's a long time. But you don't feel that because you've just hit new game. You know, you've just sat through the loading. And then all of a sudden the screen's fading up from black. You're fiddling around with the controller. You're not really paying attention. You need that moment to orient yourself in the game world before the game actually starts and starts trying to teach you things. And that's the big takeaway that I would say from having done multiple openings for multiple, like, very, very big games is give it space. It's a lot more overwhelming to start a new game than you think, especially as a developer, because you've just been breathing it for months and months and months and months, and it's old to you, but it's new and overwhelming to someone who's starting it for the first time.
Would there be, I mean, what would be an example to you of a game that has an amazing opening, in your opinion?
Oh, wow. An amazing opening.
Well, an opening that really grabbed you and you're like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
I probably would give it up for the original BioShock. We're on a plane. We're grabbing a cigarette on a plane. I'm like, okay, this is interesting. I guess this is who I'm going to be. And all of a sudden, boom, we're in the water. It's on fire. And that is leaning into how disorienting starting a game is. Because they're just going like, oh, you think you're confused? Wait. It's going to get even weirder. And all of a sudden, you're in the ocean on fire and desperately swimming towards a place. You have no idea what's going on. It's also overwhelming. And then you're in that bathysphere going down into the city. And, you know, Andrew Ryan's playing his big opening monologue. And you're just sitting there like, what is going on? What have I signed up for? And it's so intense. And that game does not let up all the way to the end. So that was an amazing experience for the first time playing through that.
So what's it like when you're having to manage multiple people? So on Starfield, for example, obviously you've got the main quest and then you've got all these other people that are working on all these other side quests, and you're trying to manage this all. And
shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Trying to make it all cohesive. What's the most difficult part of that? What's the thing that gamers just don't understand in terms of the difficulty of it?
I think the big thing that confounds everyone, including me, but when you step into leadership, you actually don't have control over anything. You think you do. You think the job is supposed to be about that, but it's not. Creative people especially are impossible to control. They are going to create whatever they want to. It's the Muppet Show. Why doesn't Kermit the Frog have control over this theater? He can't. Creative showbiz people are trouble. They're just trouble. That's the tax you pay for having their creativity, because they're doing it for their own reasons. The only thing you can do is get things out of their way so they can make things and tell them where they ultimately need to go. Where's the stage? That's pretty much all you can do. And you need to be open-minded about what they will produce and be prepared to be surprised by what they will produce. It's not what you think it will be. And you need to be okay with that. That's the big takeaway from leadership. The important thing is to make sure that everyone is aware of what the goals are so that they can drive toward it in their own way. Everyone is going to get there in their own way, whether you force them to or not. So just embrace that and have the conversation be about what goal are we trying to hit so that everyone can orienteer on their own.
That's good advice. In regards to writing, because you did quite a bit of writing, do you oversee any of the voice actors at all? Or is that handed off to someone else? Like, when I've spoken to Valve writers in the past, mm-hmm. they actually oversaw all the voice acting on the games. But do you get that responsibility? Does that fall on you, or does that get delegated to someone else?
At Bethesda, a lot of the voice acting talent was managed by a company in LA called Blind Light. And they would provide a voice director, and we would call in and be on hand during the session. So I wouldn't manage the session personally, but I would be on the phone during the session and be there to answer questions or to provide any insight, especially because we're doing a lot of nonlinear branching narrative data structures.
Yeah.
So oftentimes they would have questions about, like, I don't know why I'm saying this line, and you would have to provide context. Oh, the player just made this choice and did this thing, and so now you're responding to that, but only if this is true. So kind of keep all that in mind for the performance. And they would do an awesome job. They would get super into it. Once they got a sense of, oh, this is a choices game, and I have to kind of keep the player in mind and all the choices they can make for the performance. And then they would get into it, at least for the actors that would come back into the booth often, you know, for the big characters that had a lot of lines to record.
Is that easy to let go of though? Because I would imagine as a writer, you're writing something and you'd probably have an idea of how it should sound in your head, right? everything from the Annunciation and stuff. And so when you see it and it's not like that, are you able to just let it go? Or is there a part of you that's like, man, I wish I'd done the voice acting, or I directed the voice acting?
Oh, no. Again, it's just like any other creative output. You have to be prepared for them to do it their way and be surprised by their output. Sometimes it's better. You know, sometimes a line is...
that's true.
It's honestly kind of an okay line, or it's a mediocre line. But then they deliver it with this full throttled like force, and you're like, oh my God, it's amazing now. Like in Starfield, for example, I wrote the scenes where, spoiler alert, a person dies, and there's a whole death scene that happens. And man, the actors really went for it. It felt so personal when we got the audio back. Like I was very emotional listening to some of these lines. And I wrote these lines, you know, but the performance was something that I wasn't expecting, you know, and it really was overwhelming emotionally. Like, oh man, like they really they brought something that I didn't even see possible when I was writing these lines. So you just have to embrace it. Now, is there creative back and forth? Sure. Sometimes you have to tell them, no, that will not sound right in this context. For example, like one of the basic things is, oh, hey, this person's really far away when they're delivering this line, so you need to shout. So technical problems like that, combat lines, hey, you're dying. I don't need you to, you know, I need you to like add some gurgle to your throat because like blood's coming up and all this. So it feels a little bit more visceral. So that kind of collaboration happens in the booth, but you have to let the actor and the voice director kind of go where they need to go in order to get the best performance.
Was it always discussed to have multiple accents in the game? Like early on?
Which game?
Well, it's Starfield, right? Because you hear a whole bunch of different accents, you know, South African and Irish, and there's even New Zealand accents in there. Was that decided early on? Like, hey, because this is basically a global thing that happened, you know, from Earth, and now they're all in space, that you were going to include all these different accents?
That was something that we talked about early on, yeah. What happened to Earth? How do we represent all these different cultures? And one of the things we landed on was, let's at least make sure that there's a variety of accents that are representative of at least one of each of the continents as much as possible. We weren't going to be able to get everything. And we obviously, I think we did a little bit of recording in different languages when the voice actor was bilingual or multilingual. And we're like, hey, just like improvise a little bit to give us add a little natural, you know, in your language into some of the lines. Not a lot, but yeah, essentially, can we represent all of Earth with some of these accents? Yeah, that was kind of a tall order for just a bunch of accents to do, but that was the idea. It's the same thing with like the character designs and the population designs that went into the crowd, to the NPCs. Try to make people have a wide variety of ancestries to sort of represent that they all came from Earth, and this is what happened with all the 8 billion Earth population at the time, or whatever.
Yeah, because I was surprised to hear a New Zealand accent in it when I was playing.
Oh, nice! Yeah,
I was like, "What the?" I was like, "Because obviously, I'm not used to hearing this in like AAA games. It's usually like an American accent or a British accent or something." So it was real. Mm-hmm. It was real trippy for me to hear it.
We went to a lot of effort to try to represent as much as as conceivably possible. Obviously, you can't get everything in there.
No, but of course not.
How much can we kind of try to cram in there as much as possible?
Yeah, because you had character designs from various ancestries as well. New Zealand was another case. There was a bit of controversy. Do you know about that? There was a bit of controversy here?
No.
There was so there's a character, Nicole Henderson, the Demos Shipyard, I think. But anyway, okay. he has like the indigenous people of this country have like a moko. It's like a facial tattoo. Mm-hmm. And apparently some were quite mad about it. And it was taken out.
Oh.
Because during the gameplay sessions, the original ones that you had during the trailer and stuff, it caused a bit of controversy. It was taken out of the final game, and then it was put back in like 3 months later. But I don't know. I don't know who would oversee that. Because obviously,
I don't know.
Yeah, you wouldn't even touch that, I suppose.
I don't know. That would have been, I would assume, part of the art pipeline, but I don't really know.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you find it with, obviously, the management ballooning and all these external studios? I mean, you covered it in GDC, but because sometimes it does feel like you're the frog in the boiling water and you don't even realize that this stuff is happening, like that it's become this. But were you aware of that as you were working on Starfield? Or was it at the end of the production that we were like, wow, okay, everything's fundamentally changed in terms of working with all these different studios?
Oh, I would say it goes all the way back to around the time when we were starting Fallout 76.
Yeah.
And starting up that project, because Bethesda started to actually kind of create sister location studios. Montreal became a studio. BGS Austin became a studio. And so hitting that scale point was definitely a huge change. And, you know, in retrospect, looking back on it, it seems like a lot of very identifiable management patterns with scaling hit Bethesda at that time and continued until the release of Starfield. And afterwards, I left, so who knows. But the necessity and difficulty of scaling is just a natural human phenomenon that's very well cataloged in management science. You can only hold so many people in your head. You know, it's called Dunbar's number. It's about like 125, something like that. And that's all people between work, your family, your friends. You can only realistically know about 120 plus or minus people at any one time. So when you're in an organization that's several hundred or even several thousand, we have companies now that are tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people. You can't know them. You just can't. Your brain does not have the capacity to understand that many lives in intimate detail. So you have to start dividing your organizational structure to account for a neurological limit that your employees have. Then there's a lot of different research on team sizes. The military has a rule of sevens. For example, a squad is seven people. Beyond that, it's much harder to manage. For some reason, we just have some sort of natural limit when it comes to how many close coworkers we can have. It's about seven people. And so do you want to start dividing up your organization into sevens and have an appointed leader for every seven people? That means that's a lot of leaders. All of a sudden, a lot of middle managers you're adding to your structure. And, you know, once you're at thousands and thousands of people, you can do the math. It's very difficult, and it's a completely different organization at different levels of size. The jump from 50 to 100 is not nearly as bad as the jump from 100 to 200, because you're passing several neurological limits all at once from 100 to 200. That's one of the big danger zones in any organization's life. And so things fundamentally change. Was it unexpected? I think that it's easier for me to see it as a natural occurrence of events that you would expect in any organization that experiences that kind of growth, which, by the way, that's a huge privilege to have that kind of growth. You're lucky to have those problems.
Yeah.
Not many people can say that they worked on a product that then went on to be able to employ hundreds of people, if not thousands or tens of thousands of people. That's rarefied success. So you're very lucky to have those problems, but they are problems. And it's a lot easier for me to see in retrospect that, oh, these are natural human limitations and problems of scale. And that there are answers to scaling problems if you look outside of the games industry. You know, the tech has been dealing with this for a long time, but human industry has been dealing with this for a long time period, ever since management became its own field. How do we manage people and organizations at scale? There's a wealth of information and theory crafting around how you deal with the problem of size. And so that made it a lot easier for me to grok what was happening across a decade of growth. At the time, it just feels like things aren't working well as they used to. What we were doing before isn't working anymore. We don't know everyone at the organization the way we used to. There's something wrong, but we don't really know what, and we can't really agree on what. So we're just going to navigate the seas as best we can into the unknown together once more, and hopefully it'll work out. And it's not that anyone's doing anything wrong in terms of everyone's trying to solve the problem, but if you're in the middle of the ocean and there's pitch blackness all along and the seas are going, like, you know, just to extend this analogy even further, it's very difficult to navigate. And now that I'm ashore and I can kind of see the voyage for what it is, you're like, oh, actually, that was all very predictable. There's nothing new under the sun. Human beings haven't, you know, really changed since we started organizing into societies thousands of years ago. So these problems are manageable, but you need to know that you're having those problems and you need to be willing to put the known solutions into practice. And that's a very tall ask, especially when you're in the middle of it.
Well, yeah. And doesn't, when you have that amount of people, everything gets compounded in terms of time lost. If you have to go through multiple middle managers just for it to get to the right
communication
person.
Becomes a huge problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're playing telephone all the time.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
Time.
But is that something that you're able to be aware of and find ways to mitigate at the time? Or are you just, you're so much like the hamster on the wheel that you just, you can't even think about that stuff. You just go, go, go.
It's a little bit of both, honestly. Because you're going, you know, because you're going so much, you've got some blinders on and things are kind of hitting you out of nowhere. You think you've got a handle on it and then you don't. But that doesn't mean that people aren't making good, honest attempts to deal with the problem. One of, like, a small thing that I started doing was, instead of sitting down one-on-one to go over the tool set with whoever asked, I would just record videos anytime anyone had a question and I would send them the video. But then I would also publish that internally, and therefore everyone who had that question could see it. And that was because that was the only way to manage the scale problem. I was being inundated with requests. I didn't know when someone would need something, especially they might not be awake when I'm awake because of the time zone differences. So having a published video tutorial was the easiest way to transmit the most information in the shortest amount of time so that I could get everything across to whoever needed it. And, you know, the amount of requests I would get that I would have to manage personally would go down. So there were definitely a lot of tactics for how to manage the problem. I think it's more of that on the strategic level, we weren't aware of what were the big trends that were hitting us as an organization and how do you manage that, you know, at a much higher level. That was the part that I think took a lot of us by surprise, because you're just trying to You think you're playing the same game you were playing, you know, 4 years ago, 10 years ago, and you're just trying to manage things as best you can. But no, things have changed fundamentally because the organization has grown past these certain points. The industry is changing, the audience is changing, et cetera. And it can really take you by surprise if you're not careful.
Yeah. Is that part of the reason you left? Because everything had become siloed? Or did you just want to move on to greener pastures? Did you just not want the pressure of working on Elder Scrolls 6? Like, what was it?
I think the main thing for me was that it was mostly personal. I had been there for a long time.
Yeah, a long time.
I joined the organization in my early 20s. I was now in my early 40s. And a lot of my identity was wrapped up in this studio and its success. That's the one of the dangers of success is that it's intoxicating and it becomes a part of you that you want to hold on to. It's very hard to let go of that. And it's very difficult to separate your identity from that success and wanting to repeat that success over and over again and have that be a part of you. But it's not your identity. And one day you wake up and you're like, I don't know if I recognize myself anymore. I don't know if I've ever recognized myself anymore. I haven't taken any time since, you know, college to really ask the big questions about life and who I am and what do I want. And I think that was the point where I was like, I have a choice ahead of me. I can stay and just become the organization, be the uniform. Or I can leave and risk trying to discover who I really am. I hate to say, it sounds so hokey when I say it, but that was the choice. If I don't leave now, it is my identity.
Yeah.
Because it has been such an important part of my life. All my friends came from the studio, you know, and I had been through a lot there. You know, people left, people died. I buried two colleagues over the course of my career there. So that was very hard emotionally, you know, for all kinds of reasons. And, you know, and a lot of people left or, you know, or were fired or laid off. That also hit really hard. And so it was a choice between, do I double down on my identity as a Bethesda Game Studios developer, or do I risk trying to figure out who I really am? And that was a lot to ask. And it was hard. It's really hard figuring out who you really are and taking that time. It's like dying. It really is. You have to sort of kind of refactor everything about who you are and what you're expecting out of life. And a lot of people don't make that choice. And there's a reason why. It's because it's really difficult.
Yeah, yeah. And you wouldn't be the only one. There'd be heaps of people that have run into that same problem and trying to figure out who they are. So do you know who you are now?
I think I'm figuring it out.
Yeah.
I think the answer might be that you never really know and that it's a lifetime journey. I think that might be the real answer. The joke's on me.
Yeah. So we'll theorize here. If you had worked on Elder Scrolls 6, what is the direction you think they should go? Because obviously they can't release Skyrim 2.0, right? Because it's a completely different landscape now to when that was released. And, you know, they've got the weight of the world on them to deal with that. But if you were going to approach it, how would you approach it?
I don't think I can answer that question. It's too tempting. All of a sudden, we would be here for another 2 hours, and I would want to make that game, and I can't. So I wish them the best of luck, though. All eyes on Bethesda Game Studios, and it's a lot. It's a lot.
I would say it's probably the most anticipated game of all time behind GTA 6.
Grand Theft Auto 6, what is that like to work on?
Yeah.
That must be something. Man, that trailer was awesome, though.
It was. And, I mean, they'll surely have a second one at some point, I'm sure. But the hype behind that game is insane, right? And they have to nail it, right? Because people's expectations are just crazy.
Through the roof.
Yeah. I mean, Bruce and I...
Grand Theft Auto 5, you know, that... I mean, I can't even comprehend how successful that game's been.
But from an individual... But... Because you've been in the trenches, right? You understand it from an individual level, what it's like to feel the pressure, even on something like Starfield, right? And you had the pitchforks out on Fallout 76 initially. So you know what's at stake. So, I mean, you can probably empathize with the developers both of Elder Scrolls 6 and GTA 6.
Oh, game development in general.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but yeah. the bigger the scope, the bigger the expectations, the more, I suppose, pushback can happen if it doesn't go right.
The old saying is true, more money, more problems. Success and fame and wealth don't make your problems go away. That's one of the great ironies of life. They can pull you out of misery. You know, when you have no money and no one cares who you are or what you've done, that's a very miserable place. And success can pull you out of that. But once you're out of misery, it doesn't make you happier. It just adds, all of a sudden you have the weight of expectations and am I going to be able to live up to my success? Am I my success or am I my own person outside of my success? Is it its own thing or is it a part of me? All these existential problems, who am I really? That's actually a very luxurious problem to have, but it's still a problem and it still weighs on you. Anyone who has been successful and talks about their life in retrospect, you can tell they're not happy, you know, especially if they're still in the middle of it. Because it's such a difficult thing to maintain. So yeah. I think that's the problem of even when you're working on something that's very successful, like, you know, Grand Theft Auto, it's still like, oh man, is it going to work this time? Are we going to make it? Am I going to be responsible for adding in the one thing that tens of millions of people are going to hate? That's so crushing. So I think there's a benefit to being small and not having this enormous amount of expectations on you. But the risk there, of course, is that no one cares. You're shouting into the void and no one's responding back. And is that worse? You know, so but life has a way of making itself complicated even when things are going well.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose when you talk about like that sort of stuff, like say, you know how the sausage is made. So in this instance with like Elder Scrolls 6, you can go in as a fan, right? You don't have to worry about development or anything. You can just go in and enjoy it for what it is. Like I'm not sure as a designer, if you go back and look through a lot of your old stuff on Bethesda games and then start critiquing it and being like, oh, I should have done this or I should have done that.
I don't know. I think on some level, it's a game that I can appreciate from the outside, but I was on the inside at one point. So I don't know how it'll hit. I think it'll be very emotional for me to play any future Bethesda title.
Yeah.
Because I know what it was like, and I know those people. And it's like, I hate to keep using life analogies, but it is very much like getting divorced. You know, do you want to see your ex again? Maybe it's fine. We can have lunch, you know, talk about the old times. Or maybe that's not a great idea. I don't know. So I don't know what will happen when the next big Bethesda game comes out, how long it'll take me to actually sit down and play it. I probably will.
I've spoken to, I think, maybe over 100 game developers at this point. And one of the biggest criticisms I hear from them these days is that games are too long. Now, as someone who's been in the trenches with a company that's not exactly known for short games, I'm curious for your thoughts on that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'll say that. Because not personally responsible, but part of what happened was the success of games like Skyrim and Fallout 4, these really big titles that you can play pretty much forever. There's still a lot of people who play Skyrim.
Yeah.
Even, you know, even after all these years. And the idea of these evergreen games that you could just sink thousands of plus hours into, that hit the industry before it was MMOs were that. You know, World of Warcraft, there are World of Warcraft super fans who will never leave that game. And then all of a sudden, games like Skyrim and other open world games really hit their stride with enough content to get past the tipping point of you can kind of play it almost forever. And so that became the big trend that hit the games industry. And you can see Dark Souls and Elden Ring being a secondary trend of let's make third-person action combat really hard. And so that trend line of all of a sudden every game needed 40 plus hours of content and depth and progression systems and everything kind of became, and survival crafting because Minecraft became super popular and all of that. And now we're reaching a point where people are fatigued, or a large section or a growing section of the audience is becoming fatigued at investing 30 plus 100 plus hours into a game because they already have that. They already have the games that they will continually come back to, and adding another one to that list is a tall order. It's always a tall order. So we're seeing this resurgence of short games. Like, I just played Mouthwashing. Have you played Mouthwashing?
I haven't played it, no.
It's only like 3 hours long at most. It's a very short experience. But part of the benefit of that is the community engagement around the story of Mouthwashing is only possible because everyone who is a fan has actually played through it all the way to the end.
Yeah.
And that's important for engagement with that story, that with the story and the product. So Mouthwashing is a huge hit because it's short. There are other factors into that, the execution, you know, nice iconic key art, all that kind of stuff, but that game doesn't succeed nearly as well if it were longer and had a bunch of side quests and miscellaneous content. The shortness is the point. And that level of engagement was so refreshing to see from a developer who's done a lot of big games. It's like, oh, you can have a fan community conversation around a game that's much shorter because the shortness allows everyone to engage fully with the entirety of the product. Most games that are 10 plus hours long, most people don't finish, and I would say 75% of your players only play through the first 5 to 10 hours. So that's a huge fragmenting of your overall fan community base between the people that will play through it all the way to the end and then play it again over and over again, and the vast majority of your audience who will play it for the first 5 hours and then put it down and say, that was pretty good, and then they move on to whatever's next.
Yeah.
There's no dull moments in the games industry. Everything's always changing.
Well, I suppose even with Starfield, right? I mean, how many people have finished it? How many people would have done the main quest?
What is finished with Starfield?
Well, yeah, I suppose true. Yeah, well, any open world game for that matter. What is, like, I suppose the golden path, right? Because I know how much stress you're under. I mean, you spoke about it at the GDC, like the end of the main quest, right? And then you've got to wonder how many people actually finished it. I mean, Bethesda must have data that would, yeah. So
there's probably telemetry somewhere. Someone knows. You could probably check like achievements, like Steam achievements. Typically, tell you the percentage of players that get that particular achievement. That's public, so you can kind of extrapolate that way. But any game that you play, like check out the achievements and the percentage of players who have that achievement. It's usually, if you've engaged with that game for a long time, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So, you know, maybe 10%. I don't know. I don't know what the numbers actually are, but it's not many.
Yeah. But I think you're right in terms of short games. And I suppose with a shorter game, it's harder to, it's easier to keep the pacing like really engaging. Like it's just like this all the time. I mean, it's no surprise to me that Astrobot won Game of the Year. Was it like 12 hours or whatever it is? So there's obviously a demand for shorter games.
Nice contained experiences that I can then move on from. Because we have so many games now in our libraries that we can return to forever and ever. And there are the mammoth successes where that's, you know, if you're only engaging with one game, you're usually, it's like, okay, it's Madden or FIFA, Call of Duty, Fortnite, League of Legends, World of Warcraft, or, you know, any one of those like really big behemoth games, Skyrim, that has happened. And I think it's going to be a long time before those games leave the market. There's a huge, that who knows, like how long will Fortnite go on? It could be another 20, 30 years. Maybe it's forever. You know, sports have gone on forever. Football, soccer, basketball. It's been a long time since someone's introduced a new team sport that has, you know, huge mainstream cultural influence. And so maybe forever, maybe our lifetimes, you know, 50 years from now, there'll still be Fortnite updates and it'll still be the mammoth success that has always been. Who knows?
Yeah, I remember reading recently, Sean Layden said that the demographic has changed. So there used to be people that were money poor, but time rich. Now it's the reverse. They're money rich, but time poor. So you've got so many games and you don't have the time to complete them. And it probably doesn't help when every mainstream, well, most AAA games are, you know, anywhere from like 50 to 100 hours.
It's a lot. It's more than it depend. It also depends on the market, because now we're dealing with the global market. There's North America and Europe, but there's also India, Asia, Africa, South America. That all of these different markets have different cultures and different expectations and different, as you're saying, amounts of time and money, discretionary funds that they can spend on luxuries like entertainment. So the who knows? The games industry as a whole is gigantic. Mm. It's more than anyone can comprehend, and it's everywhere across the entire planet. So when we're talking about the games industry, usually we're only talking about some segment of the games industry for a particular market of the games industry. Oftentimes that's, you know, the AAA market in North America and Europe.
Yeah.
That is where most of the fan discourse happens, but an inordinate amount of the playtime and money is spent, say, in the mobile market in places like Asia or South America or Africa or other places where that is not something that's in the AAA North American Europe conversation.
Mm. Good point. Good point. So some of my followers asked some questions, so I thought I'd run them by you. Yeah, yeah. And maybe you can answer them. Maybe you cannot. We'll see. So first one here is from X Wild Wolf. Has Bethesda tried experimenting with other genres besides first-person RPGs, like action or racing games?
Oh, what was Bethesda ever doing stuff like that? I think while I was there. I mean, maybe Fallout 76 as a as a multiplayer game, you could consider that to be a separate genre. I know in its history, there were a number of titles that were very different before they landed on doing open world role-playing games. So you could probably just like look that up on Wikipedia and you'll find those kinds of titles.
But there was no internal discussions while you were there about doing something different. It was just moving from the next open world RPG to the next, with the exception of Fallout 76.
Well, what I would actually say there is I was always really surprised and delighted about how willing Bethesda was in experimenting with their formula, even though it was risky.
Yeah.
You know, I worked on the dialogue system for Fallout 4, for example, and, you know, Emil Pagliarulo, for example, has stated publicly that it probably wasn't a great system. And I think we all kind of internally agreed. It was really rough getting that. But I was really impressed with our willingness to do it. Taking something as you know, essential as RPG dialogue and trying to do something new with it. And the same thing true with 76. Let's try to make a different kind of a co-op multiplayer open world experience. And the same with Starfield. Let's try to take procedural content all the way to thousands of planets. I was really on board with those experiments. You could argue about whether those experiments were successful, but the willingness to try different things I thought was really important for the studio's health. And so even though like the genre was always probably going to be open world role-playing game, open world role-playing game is basically anything. You know, you can throw anything in there. You know, if you can, any genre can at least maybe be a mini game. There were several mini games in Fallout 4, for example, that were all like 2D clones, like Tapper and stuff like that. So I think that the genre was just so open-ended that you could do anything you wanted within that genre. So why not just stay there and do it there?
In regards to the planets on Starfield, how did you come to the number of planets that you guys had in the end?
I don't remember. Bruce would probably know for sure where the number came from because he was like the planets guy.
The planets guy.
And well, in terms of making sure all the astronomy was correct, like that was something he was personally passionate about. And so he put in some work there. There were other people who worked on the planet system as well. So I don't want to pave over them, but I don't know where the number actually came from. It was probably a desire to like, hey, if we roughly made it this size in terms of space, how many solar systems would that be? So I don't really know.
Yeah, because how much of a difference would it have made between like, say, 900 planets versus 1500 planets? At what point does it really matter? Or like, how much does the compounding effect of workload make it viable?
Yeah, it depends on how you build out your procedural content system. I would say for me, it was the difference between one planet or any number of planets. It would have been if we say like, hey, let's forget the procedural content. Let's just make it all handcrafted. Well, then you're looking at like a Skyrim or a Fallout 4 map. And we might as well just make it one contiguous full space at that point. If you want to make a procedural system and like procedurally gen a planet, then it kind of doesn't matter how many you make past that point. I think that realistically, a player probably is only going to visit maybe a dozen or two dozen of them, unless they want to just keep going forever. So maybe that would have been, based on the playtesting data, maybe that would have been a better amount to tune for in terms of like content density. But you're also at the mercy of how do you create the planet and stitch it together, and what are all the streaming and loading bearings? And there's all these technical limitations that are going to kind of constrain the design in certain ways. So once you decide to have ProcGen planets, it kind of doesn't matter what the number ultimately is beyond one. So it's either one or infinite. Pick any number you want.
But wouldn't you still need like a ridiculous amount of QA testers to test all that?
Well, ideally, you have subject matter expert QA that is testing the system and is going through the system as a whole. Because it's ProcGen, right? There are rules for how these things are created. So you're testing the rules of the system. And that's true of any procedural generated system. You can't test all outcomes because it's explosive, you know, exponentially explosive. It's on that huge curve. Yeah. So you have to just test the inputs and make sure that the rules for the system behave the way you would expect under various circumstances. And then you just tamp down the edge cases as best you can, but you can't really control it.
Interesting. Good to know.
Oh, yeah. It's super fun. It's a super fun problem to solve. And I appreciate the willingness to attempt that problem, even if the actual answer is it's impossible. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like
I'd rather deal with an impossible problem than be put in a box and kicked into the corner and said, don't go outside this box.
Yeah, I mean, Starfield was very, very ambitious. And I'm sure with Starfield 2, they've probably learned a lot and what to do and what not to do.
I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. Next question from Pedro Gomes-CX7KU. Interesting name. Kurt Coleman was the informal lore master of the Elder Scrolls at Bethesda. Now that he has left, who has taken up the mantle?
Oh, I don't know. I can't answer that question.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say though, man, yeah, Kurt was great. If you had any Elder Scrolls question, he knew it, or he had an opinion about it. We would get into arguments sometimes, but yeah, he really loves the Elder Scrolls. He really does.
So there wasn't anyone who was like a protege of his that could have possibly taken over. I mean, there'd obviously
I don't
be people.
No.
Yeah,
because you have. You also have the Elder Scrolls Online and all of its lore.
Yeah.
And I think ZeniMax Online Studios might even have like official lore masters, like as part of their pipeline. They need someone who can reconcile all of the lore in the Elder Scrolls universe. So they might actually have, that might actually be an official position. But internally at like Bethesda Game Studios that makes the open world single player role playing games and Fallout 76, that I don't know who that would be. Because not because there isn't anyone, but because that could be any number of people, and it kind of just depends on who the leadership or Todd or whoever wants that person to be.
Yeah, but would there be some sort of massive document at Bethesda that would contain all the lore? So
the funny thing is, one of the first assignments I had as a design intern was they were building an internal wiki site for all the lore, and they were like, I was data entering basically all of the books from all of the previous games up until Oblivion, and entering it into this lore wiki that they were building. And I eventually was looking at that again when I came back for Skyrim. So it was fun to be like, oh yeah, I remember when I added this book to the lore wiki all the you know a year or two ago. So there's internal documentation. But I also don't know what they've built out since I've left. So, who knows?
Well, I would assume you'd have some sort of contingency plan in place in the inevitable position of somebody who was basically irreplaceable, that can take up that mantle. But yeah, I'm sure there is somebody. We just don't know who it is.
Yeah, there are multiple people who could potentially fill that role. People who have been there for a long time, or people who are just very, very familiar with the Elder Scrolls. There are people who have joined the organization, at least when I was there, that were like super fans of the Elder Scrolls and could also potentially theoretically fill that slot. Or it could just be that you kind of lease it to the entire team. That might also be one way you police it is, okay, everyone just needs to be really invested in the lore and checking all the time because you're making a lot of content. So having everything go through one person to check all the lore consistencies, that might not be efficient when you're, you know, trying to go into full production mode. But anyway, who knows? Like, it's up to them now. Well, I mean, it was always up to them. But like I said, I have left, so I don't have an inside track on what might be happening there.
Yeah, fair enough. Final question from Treasure Box Reviews. You've kind of vaguely touched this, but what is it like to have to balance major story quests along with the many side quests that are required for massive open world games?
Oh, what's it like to balance the two?
Yeah,
so
difficult, I'm sure.
It all depends on how much scrutiny you're under. When you're doing the main quest, everyone's got an opinion on it because it's the story that is going to be judged alongside the rest of the game.
Right.
It's effectively a feature at that point, along with all the other gameplay features. So everyone from all the way up to all the way down, the organization has some opinion on it. So you're serving a lot of masters there. Versus if you're working on a side quest off in a corner, you might be the only person who plays that before for the game ships. Because these games are so big that maybe your lead has played it once or twice, but that might be it. And you might be struggling for resources, but that also means you have a lot of autonomy because no one cares. You get to do what you want. And and that's why I think sometimes people say, oh, the side quests are the best content, because one person probably has a lot more creative ownership over that content. And it's also, it's allowed to be different because it's not the thing that the entire game is going to be judged by. The main quest has to represent the game and the game's tone and themes. And if you don't like the game, you're not going to like the main quest. But if you're struggling with the game, but you play this really engaging side quest that bucks all of the main game's themes and does something really different or wacky, that can be a surprise enjoyment that you discover. So that's the spectrum of work that you can end up doing in content.
How do you decide though how many side quests to have?
As many as you can make.
Really? Is that essentially what it is? Just make as many as you can.
Yeah. If you've had the privilege of working on several titles in a row, then you'll have your own metrics based on past experience. Okay, how long did it take us to make quests last time? Let's take that number and extrapolate based on our deadline how many we can cram in there. And then as we get into production, we discover that the metric's wrong, because the metrics are always wrong, because it's a new game. You adjust the number, and then you have to decide, okay, well, do we add, or do we cut, or do we re-scope to try to find ways to balance that? And that's just the managerial part of product development. Okay, how many can we make? We want to make as many as possible. How many can we fit? And then by the end, it's just like, how many can we ship at the quality that we want on time? And then everything else we have to jettison.
Yeah. Is there any, I suppose, decisions to show restraint though? Because obviously you can just keep adding stuff to a game, theoretically. Like the more time you have, the more time you have to add more features to the game. And I suppose, because obviously you need to show some restraint because there needs to be a cutoff point. But I suppose it's finding the line as to where that is. And you don't want to put yourself in a position.
Yeah, this is well-trotted ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just do a production timeline where you have certain milestones in the development of the game. So, okay, usually there's like discovery, which is we don't know what we're making yet. So let's go and try a bunch of prototypes to figure out what it is that we're going to make. Then there's pre-production. Okay, we know what we're going to make, but we don't know how. So we have to figure out how we're going to make it. Then there's production, which is, okay, now we know what we're going to make and how we're going to make it. So now we need to make it. And then within production, there's like an alpha period. Okay, everything must be done in some way. It doesn't have to be polished, but it does need to be complete. Feature complete, no new features, no more content. Then beta, which is, okay, we have polished up the features and content and we've cut whatever we can't get done. And now it's just about fixing bugs. Don't try to polish anymore. Don't add in any more shine. Just fix the cracks, and then hopefully you ship.
So it's that process, but obviously you still have curveballs throughout all those different stages as well, where there are maybe things that you didn't account for that just pop up.
Yeah, exactly. The entirety of the process: discovery, pre-production, production, and ship. That can happen in a mini ecosystem just for one feature. So you can be in beta and you decide, oh, wait, we're missing this. There's this huge hole in the game. We got to add in this one thing. We're going to invest all whatever buffer time we have left into this one thing. And that thing goes from discovery all the way to beta in like a hypercell, essentially. Mm. So you can definitely end up on features and content that are pre-alpha in your beta, or in discovery in your alpha, and all this other kind of stuff. So that's where production timelines end up being kind of a lie. They're not really a lie, they're an estimate. It's not contractual, it's an estimate about what might happen. And there's an overall timeline for the game, but there are timelines for each individual features. And you can end up on a feature that is way at the early point of the timeline, even if the game as a whole is at a much later point in the timeline. So that's where a lot of the kind of confusion around where are we at with the project can happen. Because if you ask the team that's responsible for the thing that's being added, they're going to be under an immense amount of pressure to get that done, because the game is here and they're here. You know, they're at a timeline of trying to figure out what it is they're even doing. And the whole rest of the team is like, well, we got to finish. So that's a really hard place to be. But that can happen. That happens in video games, video game development all the time, especially for these big projects.
Jeez. So much. It's stuff.
A lot.
You have to take in so much. So much to take into account. Wow. I think I'm going to wrap up there so I can process all this information that you've burdened me with.
Yeah, it's more than any one person can process, you know. That's why we have teams. Yeah. Teams of people can lighten the load. Yeah. No one can do this on their own. There are amazing solo developers, don't get me wrong, but for a lot of these games you need teams of people.
Like Nate was a good example. Like solo game.
Yeah. A whole game by himself.
I know.
With
crazy.
A lot of loving support from his family.
Yeah. Before I wrap up, is there anywhere where people can follow you and keep up to date with what you're doing? Because what are you doing these days as well?
Oh, sure. I'm on the LinkedIn, and I currently work at Unknown Worlds. Those are the folks that made Subnautica. So go check out that Subnautica 2 teaser.
Nice. Cool. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. Have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. See you later.